when I landed here, I was a disaster, and these guys really took a chance on me. I'm only slightly less of a disaster now, I feel like I need to confess something to all of you, just so I can speak with a clear conscience. Last night, I ate at Taco Bell, and I know. My wife and I were trying to decide what we were going to eat, and she was like, I don't know, do you want Mexican, do you want pizza? And I thought, Mexican pizza, and I was like, we got to do Taco Bell. And so there's a good side to this. I was able to stare temptation in the face and not give in. I did not order the new Naked Chicken Chalupa, or the Naked Chicky Choop Choop, as it is become known as. It's sort of a sad thing when you can walk into a place like Taco Bell, not order the worst thing on the menu, and walk out feeling like a hero. But that's what I did. So I just felt like I needed to kind of stand before you with a clean conscience. Things are different in my lower intestine, but here we go. We're going to talk about worship. I've really enjoyed this series. When I haven't been able to be here, I've been keeping up with the podcast and listening to the other messages. It's really unique for a church to actually let worship leaders speak about worship. Normally, it's just like, yeah, sing your songs, and we'll let the real teachers talk about worship. But it's really great of you guys to have given up this space to let those of us who do this talk about what we do and why we do it. And so thank you to Norton and Stephen and all you guys for making this available to us. Just to recap a little bit from the previous weeks, because last week we took a little break while Norton was commissioned as the lead pastor here at New Denver, which was also a really worshipful time. I thought that was really great. But we're in this series called Altar. Looking at the two meanings of that word, that the altar being a physical place where we bring our worship, where we bring our praise and our remembrance and our sacrifices, but also how worship changes us, how it alters each and every one of us, that transformative power of worship. Stephen gave us a good overview on the history of worship, encouraged us not to Google animal sacrifice, which I have now on my list of things to never Google. If you want to talk about what's on that list, we'll do that later. Adam talked about listening for the whisper of God, how, you know, we don't always look for God in these like big events and these big things that happen, but sometimes God wants to speak to us in those still moments, those moments of quiet, when there aren't all these crazy things happening around us. Emily showed us that worship is sacrifice, that it always is going to cost us something. And then a couple weeks ago, Alyssa and Norton talked about something that's probably most familiar to us, and that's singing as a form of worship. And not just singing the songs, but recognizing who we're singing to and why we sing the songs that we sing. None of these things can really fully embody the concept of worship. It can be a really heady thing, and it's become that way more and more in the church. We think of it as this, you know, hyper-spiritual activity that we do, and we could each spend probably a lifetime reading or writing books about what worship is and what worship isn't. And I'm not going to be able to put a really nice bow on top of this series. You're not going to walk out of here with that one magic bullet like, oh, Brian said this, and now I know how to worship. This is really great. I just want to share my story and how that fits into worship and the things that we've talked about throughout this series, because it touches on each and every one of those. I used to think that my story was something that it wasn't anything really great. I grew up in the church and hearing people, you know, share their testimony. It was always, you know, people always had these like just wrecked lives and then God redeemed them, and my story wasn't like that. So I thought that I was just sort of like, I don't know, not a really legitimate Christian because my story was really boring. Some things that have happened that have helped me realize, like, it's not necessarily the sordid events that brought us to God's feet or brought us to that point of needing Jesus. It's grace. Grace is the plot to every single one of our stories. And so yeah, I just sort of wanted to throw that out as a disclaimer. Worship has always been part of my life. Like I mentioned, I grew up in a Christian home. My mom was raised Episcopalian. My dad was raised Methodist. They got together and got kind of caught up in the Jesus movement of the late 70s and 80s and were sort of like closet charismatics. If you're new to this whole thing, I'm probably going to throw out some terms and some things that happened in the church in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s that are going to make no sense to you. Lucky. You're so lucky that you missed out on a lot of this stuff. Early on in my parents' marriage, and when they started having kids, they adopted my mom's background, the sort of Episcopalian church background, just for the structure that it provided for them and for us as a family. But they always maintained sort of this underground charismatic, like closet charismatic thing. So we'd go to church on Sunday morning at the Episcopal Church, which was beautiful, and I loved it. And then once a week we'd meet at families' houses and kind of do this underground charismatic home church thing. So I was raised both with this, you know, the guy walking down the center aisle with the cross and being, you know, fed communion and all that kind of stuff, but then also meeting in people's houses where we'd play guitars and we'd sing, you know, we'd sing choruses and hearing my parents, you know, speak in tongues and being anointed with oil and praying for people when they were sick and praying for healing and provision and all that kind of stuff. So sometime after I turned 10, we left that Episcopal church, and for the same reasons that anybody leaves a church. People hurt people, and hurt people, and it just kind of became this really awkward situation. So my parents decided to make a change, and we kind of swung to the other end of the pendulum from Episcopal to going to a Baptist church after some church hunting and things like that. And it exposes, while we hunted for a church, we were exposed to other worship styles and things like that. We finally settled in at First Baptist Church in Sterling, Colorado. Does anybody know where Sterling is? Okay. For those of you who don't, if that screen is Colorado, Sterling is up there. You might as well just say I grew up in Nebraska. So I tell people I'm from Colorado. They're like, oh, the mountains are beautiful. I was like, I wouldn't know. There's nothing out there. So anyway, the music and stuff was great at First Baptist. It was, you know, it was an old traditional Baptist church. So, you know, we went from singing one kind of Episcopal hymns, and now we're singing Baptist hymns. And every once in a while, they'd throw in a contemporary chorus just to keep the younger folk happy. When I was 11 years old, I made the decision to follow Jesus. I will always remember when that happened, because that following summer after I was saved and got baptized, and I apologize that I do a southern accent every time I talk real churchy. That's just, those are forever linked in my mind. So anyway, I'll always remember when that happened, because that next summer my family took a trip to Disneyland. We did the whole Griswold thing where all five of us loaded in a station wagon. We drove from Sterling to Southern California, and Disneyland was closed, and my dad, no, anyway. I always think of it as like I won the spiritual Super Bowl. Like, Brian Davis, you just accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior. What are you going to do now? I'm going to Disneyland, you know? It was like that. We had the trip planned for a while. It just happened to coincide with that. So after a while, as a lot of churches did in that time, the pastor at my church decided we need to start a contemporary service. And so we started doing some more modern songs, and we put together a praise band, and my dad was asked to lead worship for that service. I was just starting to, you know, play piano and learn chord charts and all that kind of stuff, so my dad asked me if I'd play keyboard. And it had to be a synthesizer in the 90s during worship. It had to be. Worship didn't happen if you didn't have that cheesy synthesizer electric piano sound with the pad underneath it. That's how you knew the Holy Spirit was there. And so that's what I did. Of course, being a Baptist church, we had to go through the church council to make sure that we approved anything that we wanted to, you know, to change on the stage. Because how many Baptists does it take to change a light bulb? Change? Yeah. So those conversations went something like this. The church council would ask, well, where are you going to put all these people on the stage? That's what they sounded like in my head. And my dad would say, well, we're going to have to move the communion table. Well, we haven't moved the communion table in 40 years. My dad's like, well, we're not going to take an axe to it. We just want to move it back 5 feet. Well, we're going to have to vote on that. My dad just went in on a Saturday and moved the communion table anyway. And then we had to have all these discussions about drums and electric guitars and all those other satanic elements that we wanted to bring into the church. And so that's sort of the worship environment that I grew up in. Along with that, there's sort of this other undercurrent of the music that I actually listened to during this time. I will remember forever the moment that my mom sat down with myself and my younger brother and told us the story that she had heard on Dr. James Dobson's Focus on the Family radio program. Perhaps some of you remember that. And it was a story about this young man who had gotten into his dad's stuff and found his gun and shot his brother, tragically, in the face while they were listening to a Def Leppard song. And so the lesson from this is obvious. Don't let your kids play with secular music. Yes, that's correct, because guns don't kill people. Secular music kills people. And so my parents banned secular music from our home. So from the time that I was 8 years old to about the time that I was 18, all we listened to was Christian music. I had two tapes that were secular in nature. One was Lionel Richie's Dancing on the Ceiling. And the other was the California Raisins. So anybody remember the California Raisins? Yes. Yes, these animated claymation raisins singing like Motown hits from the 50s and 60s. The first CD that I ever owned was a compilation of the Dove Award nominees from 1997. Yeah, so a lot of Twyla Paris and Avalon and whatever else was in. Like I said, you didn't miss anything if you weren't a part of this all back in those days. We also listened to a lot of worship music. This sort of coincides with this big onslaught of churches putting out live worship recordings. And there were a couple of record labels that kind of jumped on this new trend. And so they started basically like the Christian version of Columbia House, if you remember that, where you'd send them money and they'd send you all these CDs. Or actually, you wouldn't even send them money, they'd just send you CDs. And who knows how Columbia House made any kind of money at all, because nobody paid for that stuff. Anyway, so we kind of had the Christian version of that, where every month my parents would get a new tape. And these were tapes. Do you all know what tapes are? Cool. We'd get a new tape every month, and we would just listen to those on car trips. And so I was really exposed to a lot of live worship recordings and different worship leaders and all that kind of stuff. And so that was the music that I listened to for about a decade. And so it's really easy to see why I now do what I do, because there was no other choice. It was either that or become a California Raisin. So growing up in a Christian home and being exposed to all these great Christian influences and all that kind of stuff, it still wasn't quite enough to keep my life from going off the rails a little bit. I grew up in a very small town, and when you do that, everybody knows you, and everybody wants to label you. And I was kind of labeled as the church kid. Because I was always at church. I was there every Sunday. I was playing on the worship team, so I was in rehearsal every Thursday. I was sometimes at youth group on Sunday night. I was the kid who was, I was going to FCA, and I would always see you at the pole and all that kind of stuff that church kids did back in that time. Oh, and Andy doesn't listen to any secular music. My friends would be like, oh, man, did you hear this new song by Criss Cross? And I'm like, who? No, I listened to Mighty Warrior by Don Moen. Would you like to listen to that with me? Who is this Belle Biv DeVoe? So the summer after my junior year of high school, I had kind of had it with being the church kid. I wanted to rebel, I wanted to be a bad boy. And so the weekend after I turned 18, my parents lifted the ban on secular music. And so my friends took me to a used record store up in Fort Collins, And I decided, I was like, okay, I'm going to get a good, like, let's see what I've been missing. And so I went for all the, like, super sad, like, you know, Gin Blossom's New Miserable Experience, and Roger Waters' The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking, which is a brilliant record, Nine Inch Nails' The Downward Spiral, and then Marilyn Manson's EP, Smells Like Children. Yeah, I went from, you know, worship music to Marilyn Manson. It was great. So I had, you know, I had the music. I was ready to, like, you know, totally redo my image. It's time to start wearing leather jackets and growing my hair long and all this stuff. And that same summer, my friends and I were hanging out, and one of my buddies pulled out a joint, marijuana, for those of you who aren't familiar with the slang terms. And I like to think that in that moment, it wasn't me who was choking and sputtering as I, you know, took hit after hit of this stuff. It was church kid that was doing this, and I was going to kill him. I was going to kill church kid with pot and with secular music and with a brooding, despondent attitude and with, you know, with beer and with partying and all this kind of stuff. I was going to kill him. And while we're at it, we'll just throw a little bit of pornography on the pile. I didn't have a real job that summer, and this is, it feels like it was ages ago. Like, the internet was just sort of becoming a thing. So it blows my kids' minds when I tell them that I didn't have an email address until I was a senior in high school. So I would spend just about all day, every day that summer in my parents' basement on the computer doing what a 17, 18-year-old kid would do if left alone with a computer. And, you know, I had seen, up to that point, you know, I had seen sex scenes and things like that in movies, and compared to what I was looking at that summer, those kinds of things were really tame. I've seen some stuff and some things, and yeah, it's left a mark for sure. And all of this kind of continued through my senior year of high school. I was sort of living these two lives in tension. I was still going to church. I was still playing on the worship team. You know, I was still participating in all these, you know, quote, Christian activities and all that kind of stuff. But I was addicted to pornography, and I was smoking pot like it was going out of style. And I just generally didn't care. Like, this is just what I do. So, you know, I kind of got my poop in a group toward the end of my senior year, and, you know, I made the decision to go to a Christian college. I went to CCU over in Lakewood, and went the path that I should have always gone. That doesn't mean that these things aren't still a struggle for me. It's a daily battle to continue to not only set aside the shame and the guilt that I feel for some of those things that I did, but also to you know, to just move forward and not get caught up in those things again. Back in 2009, I started seeing a therapist to help me kind of get to the root of some of these issues, and that's something that I've continued to do off and on through the years. And it's been a hard and messy and beautiful road that I've walked down. But one of the things that it's brought up is like, so why did I run after those things? If I had all these great influences, if I had all this, you know, basically availability to everything good, why did I run after all this other stuff? And that question's really been bothering me. And I think one of the things that I talked about with one of my therapists was the fact that it was the worship. Worship, if you think back through all the stuff that I just shared, worship was always equated with music. It was always equated with singing songs or going to a church service or some kind of event or praying a prayer or doing a devotional. It was always attached to those things and only those things. And so worship became this big. And yeah, it's no wonder that I went running after other things. See, worship in its simplest form is just ascribing worth to something. It's, you know, growing up in a Christian subculture, I have a proclivity toward making worship just a Christian practice. But all of us worship, no matter what our background, no matter where we came from, no matter where we are now. We all worship. We all look at something and we say, this thing, fill in the blank for you. This thing is worthy of all of my time, attention, and energy. We're all wired to do it. We just have this innate desire to place things above us and say, this thing is worth more than me and it deserves my allegiance. As a follower of Christ and a believer in the Bible, I believe that this desire to worship comes from God and should be directed toward God. He's jealous for the attention of his creation. And we're designed to tell him that we love him and that we believe that he's worthy of our time, attention, and energy. But early in the game, this kind of got flipped upside down. We got convinced that God was somehow holding out on us. The idea was presented that perhaps God was withholding from us the things that we really deserve. And we were told that this other thing was going to be worth our time and our attention and our energy, more so than the one who created it. And we fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And from that moment, the whole thing got turned upside down, and God and mankind, they battled hard to try to make it right. And we wrestled, and at times we gave in, and we'd fight with God, and we'd push him back. And when we didn't get what we thought we needed or wanted from him, we'd pick up all our idols, and we'd go home because God wouldn't play the way that we wanted him to. And then Jesus came. And through his death on a cross, he began this process of flipping it all back over again, where it belongs. Somewhere along the line, we heard that message of what Jesus did for us. And some of us have said, yes, Jesus, I'm gonna worship you. I think that what you have to offer me and the life that you are calling me to is more important than all these other things that I'm running after you. So I'm going to worship you. But we still find ourselves fighting it and trying to turn it back to this other way. I still find myself asking this question, like, why is this so hard? I heard someone once teach on Romans 12:1, and if you've been in the church for any amount of time, you've probably heard this verse. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. I heard this man teach on this, and that worship is a lifestyle, that every act of our lives, no matter how noble or mundane, that it should all be an act of worship that is pleasing to God. And in that moment, I felt like a complete and utter failure. Because the stuff that I'm doing in my life, there's no way that that's pleasing to God. So like I said, I feel like the reason that this happens is that our worship has become too small. When we equate it with only these like really great concepts like singing or praying or doing devotionals and stuff like that, when that's the only thing that we equate it to, then it's no wonder we go looking at something else. It's no wonder that we get addicted to things, that we have relationship problems, or we become workaholics, or we seek after perfectionism, or whatever it is for you. These are worship issues for us. When our worship becomes just a once a week shot in the arm, we're going to spend the other 6 days of the week looking for another fix. And the thing that makes this especially hard is that a lot of times the things that we go running after, whether it's a fried chicken taco, or whether it's, a needle in our arm. The thing is a lot of times those things, if we're honest, they feel better than what we do here. It feels good to eat a fried chicken taco. It doesn't always feel good to sit in a room for an hour and listen to people sing songs that we don't know, or listen to somebody preach a sermon that doesn't relate to us. The other thing is a lot of times it's also easier and more readily available to get. I can go to Taco Bell right now. They're still serving breakfast. You see how jacked up this becomes when we make worship so small, or when we worship the wrong thing. I envy those of you who are at the beginning stages of following Jesus because you don't have all this baggage that the rest of us have. I hate that worship has become just this ritual of singing songs. And I realize this is what I do for a living. But I hate it. I hate that it's so hard. I hate that I want to stop at McDonald's on my way home today. God hates it too. And I know that sounds weird. God hates things? I thought that the people that we don't like put that on signs and speak for God by saying that he hates these things. But those are his words. He said so through a prophet named Amos. He's considered a minor prophet, which sounds kind of mean, but that's what he was. He was one of the first in a line of prophets to actually speak directly to the people. Most prophets would speak to the king or the religious leaders. But Amos and some of the other minor prophets, they were speaking directly to the people. At that time, Israel had become pretty politically secure, and they were kind of spiritually smug. They had it all. They knew the right songs to sing, the right prayers to pray, the right animals to sacrifice, and when to do it to make God bless them, or so they thought. So it was in this climate that God spoke through Amos, and he said this. He said, I despise your religious feasts. I cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, getting together in rooms like this, I have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps or your guitars or your drum sets or your pianos or your brand new worship songs. But let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. Let justice roll on like a river. What does justice have to do with worship? Righteousness. What does that have to do with worship? See, we've turned our worship into an empty ritual yet again. And we've gone running after all these other things to try to make us feel better. And we've forgotten about justice and righteousness and how they relate to worship. And like I said, I'm part of the problem. I love the songs. The songs we sang this morning, loved them. Sounded amazing, and it was so great. I love the event of worship, but I've been too slow to realize that I've been selling myself and those that I lead short by just making it about the music. I struggle every time I stand on stage to line my heart up with the heartbeat of God and to not just sing the song, but to put something behind the song or in the song or find a way to connect with these songs that makes me want to do more than just sing. I see that there's injustice in the world and I want to do something about it. I want these songs to move me to actually do something more than sing the song. But like I said, I'm a mess most days. How am I supposed to then go and take care of other people? But who better to take care of the wounded and the broken than those of us who are working through our woundedness and our brokenness already? The last 7 years of my life have been kind of an example of this. When I walked through these doors and when I first met Norton and Stephen, my wife had just left me. We were beginning the process of going through a divorce. Not long after that, my brother was diagnosed with a brain tumor, which he had removed and went through all this stuff over 6 years, and then about, almost 2 years ago now, the tumor came back, and it took his life last October. Right after he was diagnosed with his first brain tumor, both my grandparents passed away within about 9 months of each other. I walked away from from what was a pretty awesome job at a really great church, doing awesome things. I moved out of the house that I shared with the woman that I had trusted with 8 years of my life. Had to walk two little girls through that process. I was able to fall in love again, which I didn't think would happen. Got married 2.5 years ago. My wife and I have a beautiful 7-month-old daughter. And there have been countless other peaks and valleys, and I've spent hours in counseling, both in professional environments and sitting on people's couches. And I've been on my face in prayer wondering if God even hears or cares about anything that I'm saying or that I'm going through. And in that, in those moments where I have felt farther from God than I have ever felt in my life, my worship has never been more real. And it's not just the songs, even though a lot of the songs that I get to lead have become more rich and become, they mean more now because of what I've been through. But it's because really the gloves are off at this point. I don't have anything to lose. I don't have anything to lose by telling you that I'm a porn addict and I've been divorced and I'm trying to figure this out, because really this is just me and God working through these things, and fortunately or unfortunately, you all get a front row seat. There's no room in my world right now to play it safe. And when I stand on the stage, or when Alyssa stands on the stage, or when Adam or whoever else is leading worship, when Norton or Stephen or Dan, when they get up to teach, what they're really doing, they're not doing this for you or at you. We're doing this with you. Because I'm broken and you're broken. And we see the brokenness in this world and we want to do something about it. And so our brokenness in those moments, they latch onto each other. And we all offer up this thing, this broken, messy thing to God. And it's more than a song at that point. It's more than a sermon. It's a yearning for justice. It's a yearning to see things be put right in people's lives, in our lives, and in the world around us. And see, we can talk about worship as a concept. And we can talk about the things that we've talked about over the last 5 weeks, prayer and sacrifice and singing. But until they become more than just another thing that we do, until they become an overflow of our hearts and a daily practice in our lives, and until we're willing to admit those broken parts of our lives to each other and find a way to connect them together, we're just making noise. The beautiful sounds that we heard this morning just become noise. Real, holistic, and all-encompassing worship, it not only alters us, but it can alter the world around us. When our worship is life-altering, it's more than just singing songs or reading books or praying prayers. It moves us to seek out pathways of justice and righteousness. So how do we break out of this rut? I've heard that preachers need to have 3 points at the end of their message. So I've tried to boil this down. What can we do to help make this a little better? A couple of them are our values here at New Denver. First thing we can do is just be present. Be here when you're here. Adam did a great job of pointing out how distracted we get on a daily basis. We're bombarded with distractions, both externally and internally. And we need to make a conscious effort to break from those distractions every once in a while and try to just sit. Identify those things for yourself. Find those things, because we all know it. But it's hard to actually do something about it and just put it down for a second. So whether that's your TV or your laptop or your phone or a nakey chicky choop choop, whatever it is, just take a break from it. Take a breath and look around. Chances are that you'll find it easier than you think to be drawn into worship when you actually stop and look at what's actually around us. We live in a beautiful place. God's fingerprints are all over it. So just stop and be here, wherever here might be for you during your day. The second thing that we can do is practice. Redirecting the focus of our worship doesn't happen by accident. It takes practice, but it also takes practices. It doesn't have to be anything really drastic, at least not at first. I have a friend who says that that you should always build sidewalks where footpaths already exist. Meaning we don't always have to forge new trails all the time. There are things that you're already doing that you can view as an act of worship to God. Whether that's taking time to make your bed every morning and say, I'm doing this as an act of worship, or you're doing the dishes and that as an act of worship, or you're getting breakfast ready for your kids as an act of worship. These are ordinary things that we can do that will get us into that mindset of worshiping. I just recently read a book called The Practice of the Presence of God. It's the story of a monk who lived in the 1600s. His name was Brother Lawrence. And this was his practice, was to just recognize the fact that wherever he was, whatever he was doing, that God was there with him. And it turned every action into an act of worship, something that he always did for the love of God, no matter how mundane or how noble it was. And I think that will also help us kind of break down those walls between sacred and secular in our lives, that there are somehow, that what I do or what Norton does or what the people on this stage do as ministry is somehow more important than what you do out in the real world. Not that this is fake. You're all in the Matrix right now. there are no noble and ignoble tasks in the kingdom of God. It's all worship. It's all, if we're doing all of it for the love of God, then we are worshiping. And that's richer than just singing songs or going to church. And the third thing is engage with the song. Even though worship is more than a song, we're still going to sing. Because Alyssa and I need to eat. just kidding. I probably need to eat less. Engage with the songs that we sing. Don't just sing mindlessly. Take time to take in those lyrics and thank God for the gift of music. Wrestle with the truth that's contained in these. And then let it motivate you to engage with the bigger song that's being sung in the world. Find out ways that you can engage in acts of justice. There are plenty of opportunities nowadays. Maybe you need to join a D group here. I'm going to do some shameless plugs for New Denver Church. Get involved in a D group. Get involved with a community of people that will help motivate you to get outside of your little bubble. We're planning a church. How can you help with that? There are a lot of other initiatives this year that New Denver wants to push forward. There's a church cooperative. Find out how you can get involved in uniting the church here in Denver. Go to Guatemala. You leave Saturday, right? Get your tickets now. now, there are going to be more trips throughout the year. We have some folks doing great missions work in Africa. Find out how you can support them. Sing the songs. Pray the prayers. Listen to the sermons. Do the devotionals. But don't just do those things. Don't sing without knowing that these songs should lead you to a life of sacrificial love and service. Because worship has the power to not only alter us, but it can alter everything. It can alter the world if we let it start in here. God, we're here and you're here. Somehow there's this beautiful, messy collision happening right now as you speak to our hearts. As you comfort us, as you convict us, as you call us, as you love us. Father, as all those things happen in this moment, and as we might be resisting it or fighting against you, or whether we're willingly opening our hands to you, at least we're engaged. At least we're here, and you're here. And so, as we take these next few moments to sing to you, help us to not just sing, but to actually engage these minds that you've given us and these hearts that you've given us. Father, help us to fight the temptation to give these hearts and minds away to things that might feel good in the moment but are far less than you. Far less loving, far less gracious, far less compassionate, far less forgiving. And we're not going to get it perfect. We're still going to eat fried chicken tacos, and we're still going to scroll through our phones mindlessly for hours at a time. So God, give us the grace that we need to always come back to you, to put those things down, to take up something even greater, to experience your love and your mercy and your grace for us. God, as we do that, we pray that you would open our hearts then and open our eyes to see the world around us, to find those opportunities where we can work in justice, where we can work to try to make things right, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of so many broken and hurting people around us.